Begging for War, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The top U.S. diplomat at the U.N. says North Korea is begging for war. But in Seoul, Kim Jong-un is not the one they're worried about.
If there is a wild card that has been introduced to this equation, it's Donald Trump.
Plus, the economic cost of shutting down DACA.
We're going to take kids who would otherwise be college graduates and doing very productive jobs 5 or 10 years from now, and we're going to shove them into the illegal economy where they're not going to be paying taxes.
And that time, Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney argued with Ronald Reagan over the Northwest Passage.
Now look, Ron, this goes right through the heart of Canada. It's frozen 90% of the year. So how on earth can your Navy call this high seas?
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us on this Labor Day. If it's attention North Korea wanted by testing a massive nuclear explosion yesterday, it worked. North Korea and its leader, Kim Jong-un, were the subjects of an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council today. Here's U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley speaking at that meeting.
Kim Jong-un's action cannot be seen as defensive. His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war.
Haley called for a strong diplomatic response to North Korea. That seemed to contradict an earlier tweet from President Trump in which he dismissed South Korean diplomatic efforts as appeasement. Washington Post correspondent Anna Fifield is in Seoul, South Korea. I asked her what was different about North Korea's latest nuclear test.
Well, the really distinctive thing, Carol, is that it's huge. A ginormous nuclear explosion. Some analysts that I've been speaking to have said that this is a city buster, that if it landed on an American city or any city for that matter, it wouldn't really matter where it hit. It would be able to cause a lot of damage. So there are still a lot of big ifs about this. I mean, North Korea has claimed that this is a hydrogen bomb, that it is able to attach to a missile capable of reaching the mainland United States. We don't know whether that is actually true, whether it is this big of a bomb and whether North Korea is able to attach it to a missile. But, you know, people don't want to find out the hard way, right? The clear thing here is that North Korea has been making very clear and alarming progress with both its missile program and its nuclear program. So it has increasingly big bombs and increasingly has the ability to deliver them to targets. It's just a matter of time, analysts say, until it really can make good on its threats.
You tweeted a picture of a taxi driver in Seoul over the weekend who told you, "We South Koreans aren't worried." Why aren't they worried?
Yeah, South Koreans have been living in the shadow of this war for, you know, more than 60 years. So they've gotten really used to it. They've been through these periods of tensions before and nothing's ever happened with it. You know, there was a shelling of an island and the torpedoing of a South Korean naval corvette by North Korea in 2010. There were also very high tensions in 2013. And so this is not seen as serious as 2013 or even 2015. You know, this is a periodic thing here. So South Koreans just are used to it. They're quite blasé about it. I haven't met anybody who's stockpiling instant noodles and water or anything like that. And in fact, if there's anything that they're worried about, if there is a wild card that has been introduced to this equation, it's not Kim Jong-un and his nuclear weapons, it's Donald Trump. That's the factor that people here worry most about because they think that Trump is unpredictable, Trump is kind of nuts, as somebody here told me today. They worry that he might launch military action or he might do something to escalate these tensions.
That's really how people think of him, the president of the United States?
Yeah, when you look at these polls of, you know, global opinion about Donald Trump, South Korea is pretty consistently scoring amongst the lowest there. Yes, people here have a very dim view of him. And yeah, nothing that's happened this week has done anything to change that. Especially, it's not just this tweet about appeasement, but, our weekend started out with news that President Trump was planning to rip up the Korea-U.S. free trade agreement when he got back from Labor Weekend on Tuesday. So this caused a lot of shock and kind of panic here, especially in government circles, that Trump would make good on that threat this week.
My final question is, there are people here in the U.S. who are worried about a nuclear war. What would you say to them?
Yeah, people here in South Korea joke that the threat becomes more real the further away you are from it. So here in South Korea, people are brushing it off, like I said earlier, whereas in the US, you know, I'm always getting messages on Twitter and things from worried moms who are saying, should my university son cancel his vacation to Japan or whatever? So it doesn't feel like we are on the brink of a nuclear war from where we are here. Like I said, in South Korea, people have become very used to this. It does feel slightly hotter than usual because of the obviously increased capacity of North Korea, but also this heightened rhetoric from both sides there. But, you know, bottom line is that it is in nobody's interest for there to be any kind of conflict out here. It's not in the US's interest. It doesn't want to get involved. It's not in South Korea's interest because North Korea has the ability to destroy Seoul with conventional artillery. And it's certainly not in North Korea's interest to escalate this because that would almost certainly be suicidal for Kim Jong-un.
Anna Fifield in Seoul for The Washington Post. Thanks, Anna.
Thanks, Carol.
In the Chinese city of Yanji today, social media showed home videos of shaking chandeliers and wobbling crockery. The city sits on the border with North Korea, close enough to the nuclear test site for the tremors to be clearly felt. North Korea does not have many friends in the international community, but in the past, China has been a powerful backer. On the line is Steve Tsang, director of the China Institute at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Steve, how has Beijing reacted to the latest test?
The Chinese government was very displeased with the test, particularly because the test happened just as President Xi Jinping was greeting his guests for the BRICS summit in Xiamen in China itself. It's a slap in the face, to say the least.
Is there any reason to think that China might now adopt a tougher policy towards North Korea?
Well, the Chinese will adopt a tougher policy. But the question really is whether the Chinese will do what it takes to make it really hurt for North Korea. And that, I think, remains to be seen. I suspect probably not.
And what would make it really hurt for North Korea?
Well, the North Korean economy is very dependent on the Chinese. About something like 90% of imports and exports go through China. So if the Chinese really cut off that economic lifeline, it will hurt the North Korean economy and it will put pressure on young Mr. Kim.
Are there specific types of trade that it could cut off without throwing away the entire relationship?
Well, China could make the supply of oil products more restrictive to North Korea, but you are not going to have any real effect on the behavior of the Kim regime. Young Mr. Kim does not bow to that kind of pressure. For him, it would be either a pretty devastating prospect of economic sanctions, or he would just go on as he has been doing in the last few years.
It seems like until now, China has kind of tolerated North Korea. It doesn't want chaos on the Korean Peninsula. But is there something that could move China to take a tougher stand?
The primary driver for Chinese policy over North Korea, apart from a wish not to see chaos on the Korean Peninsula, was a consideration that the implosion of the North Korean regime, which exists because of the support and subsidy from China, might signal to Chinese dissidents that by allowing that regime to go, the Chinese Communist Party may no longer have the political will and capacity to stay in power. So the only thing that can force the Chinese is something else that would pose even greater of a threat to the Communist Party's capacity to stay in power in China. Not much else is going to make the Chinese government change its policy.
And what would that be?
Well, what the Americans have threatened so far, the risk that the Americans will cut off economic ties with a country that trade with North Korea, meaning China, will have potentially a devastating effect on the Chinese economy. And that would potentially pose serious problem for the Communist Party to stay in power. Now, if the Chinese government believe the threat from the Trump administration is real and is imminent, I think they will have to rethink their approach to North Korea. But if they believe that the American threat is not credible, not least because it will also hurt the American economy and the global economy seriously, then I don't think the Chinese will respond to it.
But given a choice between trading with North Korea and trading with the U.S., wouldn't China stop trading with North Korea in order to maintain the U.S. trading relationship?
Well, yes, if that is going to be the choice. But will the Chinese believe that the Trump administration will put millions of American jobs at risk and hundreds of billions of American investments in China at risk? If the Chinese government can be persuaded that Trump has the capacities to deliver that, I think the Chinese government would be very seriously concerned and will change its policy from supporting the North Koreans to working with the Americans. But I don't see at the moment that the Trump threat is sufficiently credible.
Steve Tsang is director of the China Institute at the School of Oriental and African Studies at London. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Large parts of South Asia continue to struggle with heavy monsoon rains and massive flooding. Millions have been affected across India, Bangladesh, and Nepal. Hundreds of people have died. Our BBC colleague Justin Rowlett is in the state of Bihar in northern India.
Well, just getting to the affected area is a lesson in the power of flood water. Bridges have been torn down and great bites have been taken out of the raised roads that run through this area.
There was no communication possible for 3-4 days.
Anil Chamaria is coordinating the Red Cross's relief efforts in this area.
Well, if you go inside the Basti or interior village, whole village has been devastated.
Those least able to cope are hit the hardest. The people here are subsistence farmers, some of the poorest and most vulnerable people on earth. With their homes gone, whole families now live in the most rudimentary of shelters, a couple of sticks with a scrap of tarpaulin over the top, clinging to the side of the road. My house is full of water. I have so many problems, a woman called Gulan tells me. She says she's lost virtually everything she owns. My house completely collapsed in the floods, she says. Now look at us. Me and my family are just living under a plastic sheet on the roadside. Please help, she implores. The waters are receding now, but that doesn't mean the danger's over. Now the big fear is the threat of disease. Well, we come to the local hospital here in Katihar. Indian government hospitals are stretched at the best of times, and I'm just going on to one of the wards here. And the ward is full of people who've been suffering illnesses like diarrhea. The beds are just lined. It's a women's ward lined with women lying with IV drips in their arms. Some of them look very ill. I'm gonna talk to one of them. Hi, what is your name? She tells me her name is Sunita Devi and that she's come in with chronic diarrhea. Her house was flooded, she says, and a few days later she developed a fever and started vomiting. A local government health worker is sitting by her side. By coincidence, she is also called Sunita Devi. She says the community here has been hit very hard.
People have trouble getting out of their houses, even going to the toilet. There is lots of diarrhea and other illnesses. We've been doing our best to give medication to everyone who needs it and to disinfect their houses.
Just listen to that. It is raining again here in Bihar. The rains this year may have been worse than normal, but the monsoon always causes flooding in South Asia. And in a way, I guess that makes the scale of the death and destruction it has brought this year even more shocking.
The BBC's Justin Rowlett reporting from Bihar State in India. Just ahead, melting ice and legal limbo in the Northwest Passage. You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. If you look at a map of North America up in the Arctic region, you'll see the coast of Alaska on the left and Greenland on the far right. In between, there are thousands of islands that belong to Canada. And meandering through those islands is the Northwest Passage. It's a roughly 900-mile sea route that connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. It used to be choked by ice year-round, but now, because of climate change and melting ice, more and more ships are passing through. And that's highlighting the fact that the Northwest Passage has been in a sort of legal limbo for decades. The World's Carolyn Beeler explains.
You can trace the strange legal situation that governs the Northwest Passage back to the summer of 1985.
The Polar Sea, a ship from the U.S. Coast Guard, will start winding its way through the Northwest Passage on Thursday.
That lumbering icebreaker on a resupply mission was seen as a threat to Canadian sovereignty.
The trouble is, the Americans haven't asked for our permission, and they say they don't have to because the passage is an international waterway. But Canada disagrees.
As the CBC reported, Canada saw the sea route from Alaska to Greenland as internal waters. And the U.S. voyage through those waters left Canadians indignant and wanting action.
If we believe that we are really an independent country, and we do have complete sovereignty over those waters, well, then I think we should exercise whatever control is necessary.
Historically, Canadians are hyper-allergic to living alongside the United States, a country 10 times our size.
This is Derek Burney. He's a longtime Canadian diplomat and government official.
So you have to understand that there's always been a lot of tension about the borders up into the Arctic. So we even had planes flying over it, dropping Canadian flags on it just to make a statement.
This internal versus international waters dispute was such a big deal that more than a year later, in 1987, it was on the agenda when President Ronald Reagan and Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney met in Ottawa. Burney was Mulroney's chief of staff at the time, and he says the two world leaders were pretty good friends.
Did I mention that they were both Irish? They love to exchange Irish jokes at the beginning of every meeting.
Burney says that personal connection was key to solving the territorial dispute.
In any event, in the prime minister's office, very intimate, couple of sofas, couple of easy chairs, the prime minister did have an ancient globe. On that globe, the Northwest Passage looked more like the St. Lawrence River.
In other words, a lot smaller than in real life.
And so the prime minister was pointing to it, to the president, and said, now look, Ron, this goes right through the heart of Canada. It's frozen 90% of the year. So how on earth can your Navy call this high seas? And the president looked at the globe, and I can still see the quizzical look on his face. And he said, well, Brian, it's not like the map they showed me on Air Force One.
But Mulroney was a friend, and later that day, Reagan told him he wanted to fix the Northwest Passage problem. Derek Burney was assigned to negotiate for the Canadians. After months of meetings, he and his American counterpart had a breakthrough.
If we were living side by side as neighbors, if I wanted to cut across your lawn, you wouldn't mind letting me do that, provided I asked you up front, right? And we both agreed that that was the kernel of a solution.
Neither side changed their legal position. But the two countries agreed that the U.S. would always ask permission before sending icebreakers through the Northwest Passage. And the Canadians, they would always give it. It might be the most Canadian agreement ever.
Well, when you're dealing with somebody 10 times your size, you've got to be a bit nimble, eh?
The 1988 Arctic Cooperation Agreement was a stroke of diplomatic genius in that that agreement essentially enabled the two countries to agree to disagree.
This is Arctic law expert Michael Byers.
The issue today, however, is that in 1988, no one had any idea as to the future impact of climate change on the Arctic sea ice.
Ice melt means that now the Northwest Passage can be navigated not just by icebreakers, but by cruise ships, cargo ships, and adventure travelers. In 1988, 11 ships traveled in the passage. Last year, 47 did. And that increased traffic means increased risk of a collision or an oil spill in one of the hardest places in the world to stage a rescue or a cleanup. Scott Heiliman is an Arctic expert with the Ocean Conservancy who says the U.S. and Canada aren't prepared for this influx.
They don't have enough ice-breaking capacity. They don't have enough emergency responders. They haven't set out safe shipping corridors and kind of mapped those out.
The two countries are working together on some of those issues. The U.S. even advises its ships to follow Canada's strict environmental rules in the passage. But Michael Byers argues neighborly goodwill won't be enough forever.
U.S. vessels are not the problem. The problem is a foreign vessel could say that we take the view that the Northwest Passage is an international strait consistent with the U.S. government view, and therefore we don't need to comply with Canada's strict standards on ship safety, on the kind of ice strengthening that might be required for a vessel.
Rogue, unprepared ships aren't attempting the Northwest Passage just yet. It's still too dangerous. But Byers argues it's essential for the law to keep up with climate change, so melting ice doesn't bring other problems, like oil tankers that can't survive a crash with an iceberg. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Time for one more quick story before we take a break. Jetpacks, flying cars. Yeah, we haven't gotten everything the future promised us, but don't lose hope.
Hi, 你好.
This is a Chinese ad for Kentucky Fried Chicken. You're asking what's so high-tech about chicken? Okay, it's not the bird. It's the way you pay for it. Yuan Yang is the economics and technology correspondent for the Financial Times in China.
All you need to do if you're a Chinese national is to look at the screen in front of you, which will have a camera. And the camera will register your face and it will match its image of your face to the national database of Chinese identity cards, which has almost everyone in a really comprehensive database. And then it will match that picture of you to your identity, your real name, and then that name to your Alipay mobile payment account, which many people have. It's a bit like PayPal, but for mobile payments. And then that will automatically pay for you once you decide what you want to eat from KFC.
All in the blink of an eye, literally. But aren't Chinese consumers a bit worried about privacy and security issues?
There's always been a slightly different approach to privacy in China, and both in law and in the culture. I think already the amount of surveillance and ability to find out where people are and what they're doing is already really huge. I think this is actually quite minor compared to what can already be done. Because people's expectations of privacy are different, people aren't as scared as you might imagine they would be. It's seen more as an extension of something that everyone's familiar with, which is mobile payments, which are huge in China. It's the biggest mobile payment market in the world.
A brave new world for people and fried chicken alike. That was Yuan Yang with the Financial Times in China.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. So how do North Koreans feel about their country's nukes?
They like it. They like to develop the missile and bomb. Only when you get through all the war against America, you could get real happiness. That's how I learn, and that's how we are trained.
A North Korean defector's story ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. After North Korea's nuclear test this weekend, President Trump took to Twitter, as he often does, and in one of his tweets, he said the U.S. is considering stopping all trade with any country doing business with North Korea. So what would that mean, and who exactly is doing business with Pyongyang? Good questions for Isaac Stonefish. He's a senior fellow at the Asia Society in New York.
North Korea trades with well over 100 nations. China is the biggest, but you also have India, you have Germany, you have basically every country that the United States has an important trade relationship with. So the United States, or Trump, is basically saying either trade with North Korea or trade with us. Obviously, countries are going to choose trading with the United States over North Korea, but just the idea of stopping trade with, say, Germany, which exports to North Korea about $7 million of medications because Germany stops this beneficial trade. It's just crazy to me.
Some experts are dismissing Trump's threat as hyperbolic, but how would it affect Americans just in their daily lives if Trump followed through and stopped trade with these countries? You know, obviously China being our largest trading partner.
we'd have a massive economic downturn because a $650 billion trade with China, massive trade with India, and even if a lot of countries did not trade with North Korea, we'd see the end of our trade relationship with China, and tensions between the U.S. and China would raise to levels they haven't been since the 50s when the two countries were at war. It's very unlikely that Trump will do this, but it would be disastrous for the U.S. economy.
But in the case of China, wouldn't China choose the U.S. over North Korea for a trading partner?
It depends on how stringent the United States is with its definition of trade. So North Korea and China have a lot of small, rather unofficial trade links. And if it were found that some trader was still selling vegetables across the border, does that mean that the United States was going to torpedo trade on a very high level? And I think we also have to understand that the United States is no longer in a position in the world where it can tell China what to do. The two countries are in many ways roughly equal.
Now, Trump also said that he's considering stopping trade in addition to other options. What are the other options he's considering, do you think?
I think it's good that they've been a little bit coy on what these options are, but people privately talk about certain military options, perhaps something symbolic like blowing up a statue of Kim Il-sung just as a indication to North Korea that the U.S. is serious. I will say one of the benefits of North Korea's opacity and the control it has on its own people is that if the U.S. did decide to do that, there's the possibility that North Korea would not escalate because they just wouldn't tell anyone about it. They don't have accountability towards their citizens. There's no independent media that would find out. So the U.S. could make one of these strikes and the world would never know about it.
People would find out if the U.S. strategically targeted a statue. I mean, in this day and age, wouldn't we know if practically somebody sneezed over in Pyongyang?
So in 2011, the South Koreans said they responded to North Korea's shelling of a South Korean island. Now, we don't know how they responded. They could have sent over a couple of pieces of artillery. They could have killed several dozens of North Korean soldiers. And North Korea decided not to escalate. And South Korean government decided not to make a big deal out of this. And tensions subsided. So it's certainly possible that the United States does this under strict cover of secrecy, and we don't hear about it. One of the downsides of all the leaking of the Trump administration is that there's a lot less ability to keep secrecy. But I think in this case, secrecy would be better because it would allow the North Koreans to not lose face, to pretend it never happened, and to decide, okay, we're going to walk away from the brink.
Isaac Stonefish is a senior fellow at the Asia Society in New York. Thanks, Isaac.
Thanks, Carol.
North Korea uses state-controlled media to put out its threats and official propaganda, so we always know what the top North Korean brass is saying, even if we really can't tell what they might be thinking. But what about North Korea's military rank and file? What's on their minds? The World's Patrick Nguyen tracked down a former North Korean army officer to try to get a sense of that.
I had planned to meet Lee So-yoon at her house in Pyeongtaek, a city in South Korea. But she tells me she's got her 5-year-old there, and it's kind of noisy. So we just end up sitting in her car, outside a cafe, sipping milkshakes. I'm curious to hear what she thought about Americans, back when she was a sergeant in the North Korean army.
Oh, 뭐, 미제는 승냥이. 그다음 미제는 철천지 원수.
Jackals, she says. Blood-sucking vampires. Oh, and Americans are barbarians, too.
Now you're drinking milkshakes with an American. What happened?
Well, what happened was she defected in 2008. Before fleeing her country, Lee spent 10 years as a signals officer, lining up coordinates for artillery cannons pointed across the DMZ. She was in the 4th Division of the Korean People's Army, in a camp located between Pyongyang and Seoul. She slept in a barracks with 30 other women. On her first day in the camp, Lee stepped into the canteen, looked up at the wall, and saw the most amazing food menu she had ever seen.
And it was brilliant, like meat and tofu.
That's the voice of Sona Jo, a Korean filmmaker. She's helping me translate.
And also some of the like rice cakes. So I thought, wow, this is Thanksgiving Day every day.
That menu, it was bogus. Instead, the troops were fed rice with bits of corn, and not much of it.
I was always hungry.
North Korean soldiers aren't dumb, Lee says. They know they're poor. but they're told that prosperity will come if only they can destroy the United States.
Why we are so poor? Why we only get clothes every 2 years? Why we are always hungry? It's all because of America. How could we deal with this? We have to kill them.
This small, poor country has developed a missile that has managed to intimidate the most powerful military in the history of human civilization. How are people in the North Korean army feeling right now?
They like it. They like to develop the missile and bomb. Only when you get through all the war against America, you could get real happiness. That's how I learn and that's how we are trained.
Can you give some advice to someone living in California who feels afraid of a nuclear bomb coming from North Korea? Well, Lee says, don't freak out too much over the sea of fire talk. Over-the-top threats are so routine in North Korea that they've almost lost their meaning. Even when North Koreans argue, she says, they'll say, you're acting like such an American, such a rotten Yankee. North Koreans are bombarded with this heated rhetoric from teachers, from parents, on the radio, and in their marching songs. I asked Lee if she remembers any army songs. Of course, she says. There's one about how soldiers are like bullets in the dear leader's rifle, ready to fire on the enemy. But she has a question.
So her question is the song for Dear Leader, is it okay to sing it in America?
You can do whatever you want in America. Well, not anything, but you can certainly sing that song.
장군님은 명사수, 우린 명중타. 격동상태 순간에 병사는 산다. 멸적의 방아쇠 당기신다며 단방의 목표를 박살 내리라.
That was really good. You have a good singing voice. But towards the end, you almost forgot something. What would be the punishment for that?
Yeah, of course. I might be punished. So like, how dare you sing like that? It's the song for our dear leader.
In other words, a public verbal scolding. Those days are long gone for Lee. She's now the president of the New Korea Women's Union, a group that advocates for female defectors in the South. Overall, she says, life is much better. Lee is 41, married to a South Korean with a child in kindergarten. She's also now free to form her own opinions about America, the land of jackals and vampires. So I have to ask, do you have a message for the American president, Donald Trump? I'm just curious if there's anything you would like him to know or to understand as he faces this really big challenge. Lee suddenly becomes very deferential, putting down her drink, sitting up straight, measuring her words.
So first, it's really big honor to say to Donald Trump through this radio program. It's my big honor. And second, I personally think Donald Trump is cool guy. He is the man. This is the first president to really say, you North Korean will see the fire.
With fire, fury, and frankly power. The likes of which this world has never seen before.
Lee loved that speech. She enjoys watching Trump threaten the army she once served. She's pretty hawkish. She's not even opposed to the thought of war, though she doesn't talk about what that would mean for South Korea, where she lives with her family. But Lee has a message for regular Americans. Hate the regime if you want, but not the North Korean troops who are indoctrinated from birth.
North Korean soldiers, like, they're human beings, basically. They are just isolated. They're blocked from the outside of the world. They haven't experienced happiness.
For the World, Patrick Nguyen, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
As we've been hearing throughout the show, President Trump's had his hands full with North Korea in recent days. But there are other issues on his plate, like DACA, which stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's a program started under President Obama that protects undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children. Tomorrow, Trump's expected to announce his decision to end the program. Since 2012, nearly 800,000 young immigrants have received benefits through DACA, including permits to work in the U.S. So how would taking those permits away from DACA recipients affect the U.S. economy? We put that question to Ike Brannon of the Cato Institute.
I don't think for a second that these guys are going to pack up and leave the country. Most of them will go and take undocumented jobs and drop out of college. So instead of having a cohort of college graduates who are working in white-collar jobs and starting their own businesses, they'd end up much worse paid, probably not paying taxes under the table, and being a lot less productive. So in our study that we released in January, we estimated that the cost of the government in terms of reduced tax revenues would be $60 billion in the next decade, and the broader economic cost of shifting these kids into less productive jobs would be about $280 billion in the next 10 years.
How did you determine that amount? That's a lot of money.
It is. There was a Hoover Institute study that looked at H-1B visas.
And the H-1Bs are specifically visas given to talented, trained, educated people for specific industries.
That's right. So what we did is we basically compared our cohort to this H-1B cohort that the Hoover Institute looked at. We adjusted for wages and size, and we used their economic analysis to come up with our numbers.
Yeah, but they're two different groups. Why can you put them in the same category?
There are two different groups, but in general, foreign-born students who have college degrees do quite well in the labor market. And so what we did is we looked at some basic demographic and other analysis, and we said the DACA people are a lot like these H-1B people, except they're 7 to 10 years younger. So we did an adjustment for wages, and we used the analysis that they did.
When we're talking about the impact on the labor force, some have made the argument that DACA recipients are driving down blue-collar wages and taking low-skill jobs away from Americans. Have you found that in your research?
No. In general, foreigners, especially foreigners with a college education, end up mainly in white-collar jobs. The other thing to keep in mind is that foreigners are, in general, much more likely to start their own businesses.
Your research also found that the federal government stands to lose billions in tax dollars if DACA recipients are removed from the labor force. But aren't there other savings in store for the federal government if it shuts down the program, like operational costs?
So there's a few operational costs. But, you know, the other point that people have made, if the federal government were serious in trying to deport all these people, that would be incredibly expensive to track these people down and get them across.
So overall, your conclusion is in terms of economic growth and fiscal impact, you seem to be saying we're going to have a net loss if DACA program is repealed?
I think that's right. We're definitely going to lose tax revenue. We're going to take kids who would otherwise be college graduates and doing very productive jobs 5 or 10 years from now, and we're going to shove them into the illegal economy where they're not going to be paying taxes. And we can all say, well, they'll all leave the country. But for the most part, it's very difficult for us to track these people down. So in general, we're going to be taking a lot less tax revenue because of this.
Why do you think so many Americans disagree with you and think that Dreamers or DACA recipients are a drain on the economy? What are they missing?
I think if your experience is you just happen to run into a handful of immigrants here and there, and you tend to think that they aren't doing all that much, you might be able to come up with an anecdotal story that comports in your mind that these people are just a drain on the economy. But if you look at the broader numbers and what immigrants tend to do, the data tends to tell a very different story, that in general, they work hard. When they go to college, they end up dropping out at a much lower proportion than native students, and they do pretty well. So, in general, I think immigration has been a boon for the U.S. economy for a couple hundred years.
Ike Brannon is with the Cato Institute, which recently published a study on the economic and fiscal impact of repealing the DACA program. Thanks, Ike.
My pleasure.
Over the summer, the world's Richard Hall did a lot of reporting on the refugee crisis in the Mediterranean. He even spent 2 weeks with Save the Children on a rescue boat. And he's been noticing a shift in the way countries are dealing with the situation. Rich, three NGOs have suspended their migrant rescues as of August. A couple of weeks ago, Doctors Without Borders, Save the Children, and Germany's CI all said they don't feel safe anymore. Why the change?
That's right. I mean, the situation has changed dramatically in the Mediterranean this year. And the main reason is domestic political pressure in Europe is forcing the EU and European countries to really put effort into stopping migrants coming across to Europe. And the way they've done that is essentially trying to push the problem back to land. They are empowering the Libyans and trying to get the Libyans to deal with the issue rather than letting migrants cross the sea and come to Europe.
But of course, Libya is basically a failed state. So how's that working out?
Yeah, this is the issue. So what they're doing is they're giving tens of millions of dollars and euros to the Libyan Coast Guard and Libyan authorities to get them to take hold of the problem, to patrol and stop these boats coming, pick migrants up and take them back to Libya, crucially, whereas the rescue boats run by the NGOs would take people back to Europe.
I know you had personal run-ins with the Libyan Coast Guard when you were on a rescue boat. What happened?
Yeah, so this was one of the most the craziest moments on this boat while I was on it. So we were watching this rescue operation take place. There were about a dozen boats in the water filled with migrants on these really unsafe rubber dinghies. And the Libyan Coast Guard came in to monitor the rescue operation, essentially. And we were kind of looking the other way, focusing on what was happening over there. And we suddenly heard gunshots. And migrants dived from their boats into the water. And suddenly there were dozens of people swimming in the water, some without life jackets, some had them on. And this is one of the key issues with this whole EU push to give the Libyan Coast Guard the responsibility is that the Libyan Coast Guard has been reckless. They've acted threateningly towards the NGOs and towards the migrants. And NGOs say that the Libyan Coast Guard makes this situation way more dangerous and more people will die if they're given more responsibility.
In this case, where were they shooting these bullets? What was happening when you heard these gunshots? What was going on?
So we later found out, we didn't know what was going on at the time because we were kind of watching from afar. We just saw them fall in the water. But we later found out that they were firing into the water right next to the boat, trying to intimidate them. And we later heard reports from some of the migrants that the Libyan Coast Guard soldiers went onto the boat and asked for mobile phones and wallets. So, I mean, this isn't a professional force in a sense. These are kind of, it's a kind of ramshackle organization in that way.
Is all this pressure from the EU working?
It's strange, actually. So in recent months, there has been a drop in the number of people traveling across the Mediterranean. But if you speak to migration experts, they're saying it's not really because of this pressure at sea from the Coast Guard and such. There was actually a deal struck between the EU and one of the major militias in Libya to stop people smuggling, to stop trafficking across the sea. So what they're essentially doing is paying this militia not to smuggle anymore.
And so what's the ripple effect on migrants themselves? Are fewer going to Libya in the first place? Are they finding different routes around?
Well, there's no indication that fewer of them are traveling to Libya. So what would happen if this is the case is that I guess more of them would be being locked up in these horrible detention centers that we heard about. And if we take a wider view of it, more people are still going to try and cross the sea. And what will happen if the NGOs aren't there because they feel unsafe is that more people will drown.
The world's Rich Hall on the shifting situation in the Mediterranean. Thanks so much, Rich.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to find out what it's like on a migrant rescue boat, we've put together an interactive diary with sights and sounds from Rich's reporting this summer. Just go to PRI.org and check it out. There isn't much to be happy about in Syria these days. For the past 6 years, the country has been divided and scarred by civil war. Thousands and thousands have died and millions have fled the country. And most of those who remain are struggling to cope with the effects of violence and poverty. But there's one thing that gives many Syrians something to smile about: the national soccer team. If they beat Iran tomorrow, they have a chance to qualify for the World Cup for the first time ever. Amar al-Azam is from Syria and a professor at Shawnee State University in Ohio and a huge soccer fan. Amar, we're usually talking to you about depressing things like war in Syria, but today we're talking soccer. How does that feel?
It feels much better. I mean, I suspect that on Tuesday, people all over Syria and the world, whether they're opposition or regime supporters, will be sitting in front of their TV screens following the progress of the Syrian national team.
What's the relationship between this Syrian national soccer team, the players, and the regime of Bashar al-Assad?
I mean, on a personal level, there's probably little or no relationship, but the regime always makes sure that any possibility it has or any chance it has of promoting itself and particularly promoting Bashar al-Assad will be exploited. So, for example, we've seen the team go out, play, and you know, later on hang around with T-shirts with Bashar al-Assad on it.
Will Syrians inside Syria be able to see tomorrow's match against Iran?
I'm sure they will. I mean, the match will be broadcast on numerous TV and satellite stations, and I'm sure the official Syrian television will probably televise it as well. The only thing that I think will prevent Syrians from seeing this match, if they're living inside Syria, is the availability of electricity. And so maybe it'd be quite interesting to look at which areas got electricity tomorrow evening in Syria and which areas didn't, to tell you which areas are in favor with the regime and which areas are not.
Syria, is overwhelmed with all sorts of problems, you know, including a huge civil war. Are people in Syria following their soccer team? Is it a big deal there?
Yes, it gives them something to look beyond the war. And for me, it's an interesting dynamic because, you know, we look at Syria today and we see a society that's completely ruptured across every possible cleavage, you know. There's almost no common denominator between the two sides. There's no common space left between them. And yet here you have a simple event like a match that could possibly help the Syrian football team qualify for the World Cup, and suddenly Syrians are forgetting their differences, if you will, and for that short period of time when the match is being played, they're all rallying and supporting that Syrian team. I think this is kind of good because it gives hope that one day this conflict will end and there are still these common areas, common space left for Syrians to come back together and talk to each other and somehow, you know, reconcile with each other despite everything that's happened to them.
Amr al-Azm is from Syria. He's a soccer fan, and he's a professor at Shawnee State University in Ohio. Thanks a lot, Amr.
Thank you.
And that's our show on this Labor Day. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.